is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Oh, it's so nice to be with you today. Actually, this isn't my line. This is Doug's line. He sent me a note about this. He says, you really can't make this stuff up, right? Bernie drew a near-capacity crowd, 7,500 people in Portland, Maine last night. Not exactly a hotbed of liberalism. I don't know, maybe it is. Portland, you know, it's the biggest city in Maine. But, I mean, you know, Maine's got a Tea Party governor, right? Paul LePage. Anyhow, 7,500 people, and some people are estimating it was a lot more than that. There were a lot of people who apparently couldn't get in. They had to open up parts of the arena that had been blocked off, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To speak to and on behalf of working people. Interestingly, Doug writes, Jeb Bush was also in Maine yesterday. He didn't bother filling an arena of working people on a Monday night, 7 months before Maine holds their caucuses like Bernie did. What he did do was have a private dinner with Mitt Romney and family at the Bush Estate here in Maine. And he will be holding a retreat for his donors in Kennebunkport later this week. Doesn't that kind of tell the whole story? I mean, it's like a story of a tale of two countries or something. There's a bunch of things that I want to get into today. One of them is, what do we do about the South? And I'm going to get to that in a couple of minutes. Another one is, what can we learn about Greece? Or what can we learn from Greece about the United States? There's a hysterical Twitter war that Donald Trump got caught up in. He's saying that when he retweeted the Jeb Bush must like illegal Mexicans because of his wife tweet, that it was somebody on his staff who did it. I don't know who did that. I didn't do that. Right. So if that's true. Let me find this here. This is the problem when I got 30 stories I want to talk about. Okay. You know the show Modern Family? I confess I've never seen it, but is it an animated comedy? Does anybody, either of you guys know? No? It's just a sitcom? Yeah. Okay. Well, Modern Family is a TV show that, you know, many of you have probably watched. And one of the guys who is like one of the main writers for Modern Family, a guy by the name of Danny Zucker, Z-U-K-E-R. this is I just have to share this with you. This is hysterical. I got this, by the way, from Democratic Underground this morning. This is a post from Cali Democrat. Donald J. Trump, the real at real Donald Trump, right? I've been warning about China since the early 80s. No one wanted to listen. Now our country is in real trouble. #time to get tough. So Danny Zucker replies, hey, real Donald Trump, you've always been tough on China, sir, particularly the children who make your crappy clothes. He used a slightly different word, but I can't say it on the air. So, the Donald J. Trump signature collection that Macy's just dropped, made in China. In fact, there's a picture of it here attached to the tweet. So Donald Trump responds, Danny, you're a total loser. Danny replies, Trump, the real Donald Trump, your insults need work. Here's what I've been working on. Every picture you post of yourself is a dick pic. See, you can do it like that. Donald Trump, I can't resist hitting lightweight Danny at Danny Zucker verbally when he starts up because he is just so pathetic and easy. It's stupid. And this is, Donald Trump's announcement was name-calling, right? The most famous of it was the name-calling of Mexican immigrants, but it's just like, so Danny Zucker replies, Trump says, I can't resist hitting lightweight Danny Zucker verbally when he starts up because he's just so pathetic and easy and stupid. Danny Zucker replies, since you're unable to manufacture decent comebacks, maybe you could outsource the job to China? #LOL. #TrumpleStiltskin. TrumpleStiltskin. So Donald Trump replies, Lightweight Danny Zucker, at Danny Zucker, is too stupid to see that China and others is destroying the U.S. economically, and our leaders are helpless. Sad. Danny Zucker replied, I am definitely too stupid to see how manufacturing your crappy clothes in China while you bloviate about them isn't hypocritical. Now, at that point, Donald Trump probably should have just stopped. But I think we've seen a lot of times when he really should have just stopped. So then he replies, just tried watching Modern Family, written by a moron. Really boring. Writer has the mind of a very dumb and backward child. Sorry, Danny. Danny Zucker, real Donald Trump. Real Donald Trump doesn't like the show I work on, but then we've never tested well with the racist, hypocritical, multiple bankruptcy demo. Donald J. Trump. Who on earth is Danny Zucker, a lightweight moron who only gets attention by attacking Trump? Danny Zucker. Clearly the one thing Real Donald Trump didn't inherit from his daddy was a thesaurus. Danny Zucker. Bye for now, Real Donald Trump. I have a busy night of not grandstanding to put the wrong people to death in the Central Park mugging case. I don't know if you remember it, but the I think it was four or five young black men who were arrested and wrongfully convicted, sent to prison for years for raping and murdering a I think she died. Either she died or she had a horrible amnesia. A jogger in Central Park years ago. And it turned out it was a serial rapist. You know, when they finally got the DNA and did the tests and stuff, it was none of these kids. It was, in fact, I think it was a white guy. But Donald Trump had just hyped that like crazy. Which reminds me, you know, the next Willie Horton has appeared. He was at the top of Drudge yesterday. In fact, I should take a look right now and see if he's still at the top of Drudge. I mean, this is the kind of thing that, you know, Fox News is all over it. Yeah, here, very top. Six times deported, illegal charge, and felony hit and run. Oh, that's a different one. Okay, but, you know, this... But, you know, there's this guy who had been deported five times. He had been convicted of felonies in the United States and deported back to Mexico. And each time he came back into the country, and he was in San Francisco, and he killed a woman last week. And Fox News and Drudge are and Donald Trump are trying to turn him into Willie Horton. Right. I can just see the ads. You know, where's Lee Atwater when you need him? Okay, a couple, you know, as I said, I want to get to the South, and I'm going to get to the South in about another 5 minutes. But I did want to just give you a heads up on something else here. Those of you who live in Wisconsin, Scuba posting over at DU, this is from watchdog.org. The Badger State, once again, has the most well-funded public pension system in the nation. Oh, my. So the government workers in Wisconsin have the best funded pension system in the United States. They have a safe retirement. So what do the Republicans want to do? Take it over! Yes! The poster says, I wondered when the next assault on the best pension system in the world would begin. Well, it has. You need to know this and take action today. The Wisconsin Joint Finance Committee has inserted an anonymous number 999 stealth provision, 27A page 9, into the Wisconsin state budget that drastically changes the way in which our Wisconsin retirement system is governed. It was slipped into the budget over the holiday weekend in the same way that the very short-lived No More Open Records language was. Bottom line, under the new law, Republicans can now do whatever they like in regard to the WRS since they have majority status and therefore total control. If this budget passes. Amazing. Coming up after the break, what do we do about the South?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You think Jeb Bush could draw 7,500 people in Portland, Maine to a stadium? Somehow I doubt it. It seems like maybe 30 people show up. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Susan watching Free Speech TV in Worcester, Ohio on the Dish Network. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
I heard Rush Limbaugh talking about the problem in Greece. and he blames it all on the social programs that are out of control there.
Right.
And he cited an example, and I you're the only person I could think of, because I went on the internet and I couldn't find anything about it, so I figured you'd know. He cited an example of some island in Greece where 60% of the population claims to be blind so that they can collect welfare. And I've never heard of this island, but, you know, doesn't sound like it's true, but you never know. And
It's not inconceivable that a bunch of blind people got together and said, hey, let's all hang out together on this island.
That's what I said. That's what I think.
I don't have any. Yeah, I've never heard of this, but, you know, this is how the right wing does it. They will cherry pick one little detail, and more often than not, they have to twist or distort it in order to make it work. And then they turn that into the metaphor for everything. You know, it's like the Willie Horton thing, or it's like, you know, undocumented Mexican in San Francisco who killed this woman last week. They become the face of, you know, Willie Horton became the face of all black people, you know, when George Herbert Walker Bush was running against Michael Dukakis. And Dukakis was on the side of the black people, and how dare he? You know, we can't have that. And, you know, they're going to do the same thing with this Mexican guy. And it sounds like that was, I mean, either that or he just pulled it out of his backside. I don't know.
Well,
I mean, you know, I've never heard of it before though, Susan.
Okay.
Oh,
you
got it?
That's why I wondered, because I hadn't either, but I figured you'd know. But I have another.
Troy just tracked it down. He sent me an email about it. It's 1.8% of the 39,000 people on the island are blind, which is nine times the prevalence of blindness normally. I mean, maybe it's genetic. You know, sometimes island populations get inbred fairly intensely. But it's 1.9%. Yeah. It wasn't 60%.
Wow, that's an exaggeration.
Yeah. Yeah, and tip of the hat to my temporary associate producer here, Troy Miller, who's filling in for Shano today, for tracking that down while we're talking.
Tell him I said thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Susan. Thank you for the call.
I have a friend who is going to argue this with me.
Uh-huh.
And I need some I need a way to I need an argument. I mean,
this Limbaugh thing in Greece?
Yeah, about all the whole thing in Greece, because he's made millions. He's, you know, on the stock market.
Yeah.
And he's always arguing with me about stuff like this.
Yeah. I will be talking about Greece in the next hour. In all probability, in fact, almost certainly, because Greece, is an amazing story that has to do with Reaganomics. But we'll get to that. Thank you for the call, sir. Welcome back. Okay, I want to get into the South here, and I'm going to get off on this rant and then I'll be picking up your calls at the bottom of the hour. But I don't know if you saw this piece by Michael Lind in Politico. It's titled, How the South Skews America. You know, the United States has some pretty bad statistics. This is not from Michael Lind's piece. This is from an op-ed by Nick Kristof in the New York Times. But the United States, we rank 30th in life expectancy, 38th in saving children's lives, 55th in women surviving childbirth. We have one of the world's highest homicide rates for developed nation. We have higher traffic fatality rates than 37 other countries, higher suicide rates than 80 other countries. We rank 32nd in preventing early marriage, 38th in the equality of our education system, 49th in high school enrollment rates, and 87th in cell phone use. We're number 49. We're number 87, right? So what Michael Lind writes is in practice, he talks about, you know, American exceptionalism. And that we're a special nation uniquely founded on high ideals like freedom and equality. But in practice, he says, much of what sets the United States apart from other countries today is actually Southern exceptionalism. Now, listen to this in the context of my question. Should we, A, reoccupy the South with Union forces and restart Reconstruction, which came to a screeching halt in 1870, whatever it was, 74, I think, the election of Rutherford B. Hayes. He needed one vote in the House of Representatives to win. It was one of those contested elections that went to the House. And the deal he made with the Southern legislators was that if he became president, he would pull the Union troops out of the South and basically end Reconstruction. 1876. Thank you, Troy. So, you know, should we A, restart Reconstruction? Or B, just let the South go their own way? Let the Confederate States say, you can fly that flag, you can have your own country. Good luck. Now, I know many of you live in the South, and that may not sound real exciting to you. Maybe the North should, although I think that, you know, if the South seceded, then a lot of people would move to the North, and people like Donald Trump could move to Miami and or down to the South. But anyhow, here's what he's saying. We have higher violence, we have lower social mobility than, for example, the other English-speaking countries, Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. We don't have a national healthcare system like they all do. We don't have a good retirement program like they all do. You know, we have, you know, we're a wreck compared to these countries. Why? Because of the South. Basically, if you take the Southern states out of the measurement, if you take all of the former Confederacy out of the measurement, then the United States actually stacks up pretty well. He said the South really is different from the rest of the country. Today, there is more intergenerational social mobility than in Europe than in the United States, contrary to the American myth that we're still number one as the land of opportunity. And children are far less likely to rise above their socioeconomic levels of their parents in the United States than are those in Britain, Canada, and Australia, as well as Germany, France, and the Nordic nations. The American South, with the lowest rates of intergenerational social mobility in the United States, clearly skews the national statistics, creating an embarrassing and depressing version of American exceptionalism. Income inequality? He says, apart from California and New York, which is Wall Street and Hollywood and Silicon Valley, the South is the region with the greatest income inequality. Southern exceptionalism has helped to ensure that the American dream is more likely to be realized in Europe than in the United States, in the old world rather than the new, he writes. He says, Britain peacefully abolished slavery within its empire in the 1830s. Thanks to Southern opposition, the U.S. only did so as a result of a catastrophic civil war. And thanks to mid-century Southern members of Congress, welfare state policies from home ownership to Social Security were designed to reinforce segregation or exclude the disproportionately Southern black poor and white poor. Not until the 1960s, with the help of federal military intervention in southern states, was the right of African Americans to vote secured. And today, white Republicans are at the forefront in the South of efforts to roll back voting rights by making voter registration more difficult. Meanwhile, this is from politicsthatwork.com. Lifespans differ dramatically from state to state. Here are the highest lifespans in the United States: New York, Hawaii, Minnesota, California, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Colorado, Wisconsin, and Rhode Island. These are all blue states. Here are the lowest life expectancies in the United States. And we're talking about, you know, 6.5 years less life. North Carolina, Indiana, Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Alabama, West Virginia, Mississippi. All except Indiana and West Virginia were former slave states. An amazing piece, by the way, over at TPM. I'll get to this when we come back on the other end, on the other side of this break. Going back to an article that was in Ebony Magazine in the spring of 1955, that takes us back to the South.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So the question for this hour is, what should we do about the South? They're screwing up our country. Well, it's not all of the South, obviously. You get it. Okay, this Florida sheriff, this is in 1955. This is, I was alive at this time. I was 4 years old, but I, you know, this is in my lifetime and the lifetime of many of you. This article in Ebony Magazine, reprinted in over a Talking Points memo today. It shows a picture of a family, husband and wife, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 children. And they had been considered white. Well, I'll read you the article because you can't see their pictures. Overnight, the Platts, free, quote, white Americans. Keep in mind, this is 1955 in Ebony Magazine. Overnight, the Platts, free white Americans, became Negroes. Whites all their lives, the Platt family crossed the racial borderline after Willis V. McCall, feared Florida sheriff and sometimes, quote, anthropologist, end quote, found the broad noses and brown skins of some of the Platt children offensive to his sense of whiteness. Perhaps the first white family to learn firsthand what it means to be a Negro, barred from the best schools because of a nose, ostracized because of the tint of the skin, orange picker Alan and Laura Platt termed their adventure a tragic nightmare. Displaying documents that identify the family as white Americans of Irish and Indian ancestry, Alan asked sadly, why does this happen to us? Part of the answer lies in the brown skins of the Platts. This caused open wonder when the family settled in the little resort town of Mount Dora, Florida last fall. The Platt children, however, attended white schools and were accepted as whites. The trouble started when Denzel, the brownest of the Platts, was barred from a white Mount Dora theater. Then Sheriff McCall began his anthropological examination. Accompanied by two armed deputies and a photographer, Sheriff McCall descended on the Platt household in the dark of night. The frightened, hysterical youngsters were lined up Gestapo fashion and photographed. Earlier, Alan said, Sheriff McCall commented, you know, Denzel favors, as in looks like, an N-word. And after a squint-eyed examination, the bespectacled sheriff pointed to Laura Bell, 13, and said, I don't like the shape of that one's nose. Five of the Platt children were then barred from the modern white school. A little later, the Platt's landlady was threatened, and the family had to move, first to another house near Mount Dora, and finally into neighboring Orange County, legally safe from Sheriff McCall. As Allen appealed to the governor for common justice, the search for non-white whites continued in McCall-run Lake County. Two-part Indian boys were barred from a white school in Eustis. 1955. This is a year after Brown v. Board. You know, I mentioned earlier I was talking about the South and what do we do about the South. You know, if we didn't have these Southern states dragging down our statistics, they have the greatest poverty, they have the greatest crime rates, they have the highest rates of sexually transmitted diseases, the highest rates of teenage pregnancies, the greatest inequality. Their politicians are actively working to prevent people of color from voting, and old people and young people. If we didn't have the South weighing us down, we, you know, this country would actually be in pretty good shape. And politically, we might start looking like Canada or New Zealand, like with the national health care system. I mean, the only states, you know, all of the states except one who have refused to expand Medicaid are former slave-holding states. It's the old South. So, yeah, that was 1955. Okay, flash forward to yesterday. Excuse me. This was in February. But this is a story in yesterday's Huffington Post. When it's because this kid is now ending up in court. His hearing was June 12th. When 24-year-old Dewan Wallace saw flashing blue lights in his rearview mirror while driving along a dark road in Cokeville Township, Michigan. The Cokes bought a town? Anyway, maybe it's Cotchville. Township, Michigan, early one morning in February. He says he chose to proceed with caution. Wallace told MLive, I live in Detroit, and I know some people who were robbed by fake police officers. I was taught to find a well-lit area to pull over in. And by the way, he's right. They note, in 2013, authorities actually issued a warning to residents in the Detroit area after a string of incidents in which people were robbed and assaulted by men claiming to be police officers. So Wallace drove at a low speed. Wallace is black. At a low speed with a police car in tow for about a mile and a half before coming to a stop at a Sam's Club parking lot where he was arrested by Saginaw Valley State University police officer Leon Wilson. Wallace now faces a felony count of fleeing and eluding police for not pulling over sooner, a charge that carries a potential two-year jail sentence. Now, he said he was just doing what everybody was told to do by the police department, which is if you see flashing lights behind you and you can't see the shield on the side of the car, all you see are the lights, which is what his experience was. And it was in a dark, unlit area. There had been a string of people putting cop lights on the top of cars, pulling people over, and then robbing them, and in some cases raping them. At a preliminary hearing on June 12th, Wallace attempted to explain why he didn't stop immediately. The prosecution responded by offering Wallace a reduced charge of attempted fourth-degree fleeing and eluding. If Wallace pleads guilty to a one-year misdemeanor with a delay sentence, the charge would be dismissed after he completes probation, but not before potentially losing his job and his financial aid to go to college. This is a kid, by the way, who's working on his master's degree in public health administration. But, you know, he's black. And hear this from today's New York Times. Study documents the paucity of black elected prosecutors. In most states, the number of black elected prosecutors, zero. About 95% of the 2,437 elected state and local prosecutors across the United States last year were white, and 79% were white men, while white men make up only 31% of the population of this country. 15 states had exclusively white elected prosecutors. Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Idaho, Maine, Montana, Nebraska, New Jersey, Oregon, Rhode Island, South Dakota, Tennessee, Vermont, Washington, and Wyoming. In Kentucky and Missouri, which also has more than 100 elected prosecutors, all but one was white. Melba V. Pearson, a Miami lawyer and president of the National Black Prosecutors Association, said a long stain caused by the imbalance was responsible for mistrust in the system by African Americans and other minorities. Now, think back to the story that I just told you about DeJuan Wallace. Black kid, he gets arrested for driving to a well-lit area before he pulls over for a traffic stop, which I have done, by the way. I mean, I've had police cars come up behind me, turn on their lights, and, you know, I drive for another half a mile or so until there's an appropriate place to pull over. You know, you don't just, like, stop in the middle of the street. Nobody's ever arrested me for that. So this kid almost certainly was confronted with a white prosecutor. And as Melba Pearson says, this is the responsible for the mistrust in the system by African Americans and other minorities. She says they have to see someone who looks like them. When you walk into a courtroom and no one looks like you, do you think you're going to get a fair shake? Think about that, white people. So what do we do about the South? They're screwing up the national statistics. They are oppressing their own people. I'm half inclined to say, let's finish Reconstruction. That way all the good liberals who are living in the South can continue living there. And let's just go in and clean it up. Let's raise the living standards of people. Let's change our trade policies and bring back the factories and the jobs. Put people back to work. Make the government the employer of last resort, like Franklin Roosevelt did. Start rebuilding the South. Rebuild the schools. Let's start with the schools and the hospitals and the transportation infrastructure. There's a lot of good people there, and there's a lot of good assets. So what do we do with the South? Or do we just let them continue to dominate our politics? I mean, this is pretty amazing. And this is not entirely the South. This is just, you know, what the Republicans have been up to recently. And I'm going to have to print this out again because I cannot read these. But in 9 states, for every vote it takes to elect one Republican member to the House of Representatives, it takes between 2 and 3 Democratic members, Democratic voters to elect one U.S. representative, one member of the House of Representatives. Why? Because of gerrymandering. This is, you know, very intentional, very carefully done. These guys have figured out how to draw the map. So anyhow, back with your calls after this. I've went off on a long rant here. It's Anything Goes Summer in addition, if you've got anything else you want to get into. I noticed we have a caller who was at the Portland Bernie rally and traded TAA. Somebody wants to talk about it. We'll get to the end of the
summer. You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls after this. Welcome back. Merwinna in Manchester Township, New Jersey, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Merwinna, what's up?
Oh, I wanted to talk to you about the... Hello?
Yeah, I'm
here. Have I got you?
Yep.
Okay. I wanted to talk to you about the plan to spend $700 billion on retraining workers displaced by the TPP.
Sure. It's only million, though. It's not billion.
$700 million.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. I was working at the Penn Valley Community College in Kansas City in the 80s when the Ford plant, one of the Ford plants and the giant Fisher Body division of GM all closed down in the same week.
Hmm.
And we lost 8,500 jobs.
Wow.
Yeah.
Were those jobs that went to Mexico?
I don't know where they went.
Yeah.
The,
what year was that?
My dad retired out of that GM plant.
Yeah, what year was that, Merwinna?
I think it was 80, I want to say 88.
Yeah.
But I was working, I was still an undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
We lost all those jobs, and a provision in the contract said that the company had to provide retraining for these people
right.
that were displaced, which was great, sounds great on paper. At that time, we had like 2 or 3 private, for-profit trade schools.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of them went pretty much to the various community colleges in the area. We got hundreds of them.
Mm-hmm.
We got, and here's why that program, that means that I've got experience with that type of retraining, massive retraining.
Right.
Here's why it didn't work.
Okay, it didn't
Most
work.
Most of those
okay.
people displaced had never been to inside a college in their lives and never intended to. Many, many of them never finished high school.
Right.
And that's fine if your job is just putting a wheel on a car.
Right.
No problem. But you come over to the community college, we expect you to take a few academics along with the job training. And we had an extensive vocational training at the school. We had food and lodging. We had HVAC. We had we even had a course in using polygraph.
Mm-hmm.
But you still, by state law, have to take English and history or political science and math. These things were necessary, and you couldn't get out of them. And these people were totally unprepared for that.
Right.
We had to give them about 4 classes in grammar before they were prepared for the remedial class in English.
Wow.
It was the same way with the math classes. I mean, these were people who came in and didn't know what a sentence was and never really mastered the multiplication tables.
Right.
And again, it doesn't matter. You got 5 bolts, you take the speed wrench, you put the wheel on the car, you hit the 5.
Right. So after they went through all this remedial education and then education, did these people find jobs?
They didn't finish the courses.
Yeah, of course.
About 1 in maybe 8 actually finish the remedial courses.
Right, yeah.
And then another problem was that the jobs that they were training for were non-existent.
Right.
Or they were jobs that, for example, there was one course in...
Merwin, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but I get your point, and I appreciate your sharing your story with us. It's an extraordinary one. And it's a cautionary tale for today. It really is. Thank you. Okay, so the South with, you know, the best predictor of whether people are going to have a hard time voting, whether they're going to have a hard time getting health insurance, whether they're going to be, they're going to end up in prison. The best predictor, you know, of a whole bunch of negative social outcomes is whether they live in the South. So what do we do about that? Shannon in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Shannon.
Hey. I wanted to talk about what we do with the South,
yes,
what
please.
We do with Greece, and your involvement with the Sons of the American Revolution.
Okay.
I am a DAR myself.
Uh-huh.
And you know, one of our founding principles is civic education, historic preservation, and patriotism.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, involving ourselves in a non-political way at the committee level, at the social level, with outreach and committees, to actually reach out and teach people where we came from, learn about where we came from, how did we get here, why did we do this, and what are we going to do from here?
Right.
You know, I like you, kind of ventured into my personal history through ancestors. I had some old boxes, you know, and I started going through the boxes, and what are these boxes about, and who were these people? And you know,
Shannon,
they weren't living relatives. He was, but,
pardon my interruption.
My point on the South, yes.
Yeah, if you could get to that, because I got a bunch of people who want to get in here. We've just got about 4 minutes left.
But on the South, I found out that the majority of my relatives, actually most all of them, ended up on the Union side. I lost a great-great-grandfather and an uncle. They died on because they worked on the Underground Railroad. Another one was imprisoned in Andersonville. Another one died.
So what do we do about the South, Shannon?
What do we do about the South? We educate them. They talk about heritage. They talk about patriotism. But the patriotism that they seem to be upholding is secessionism.
But see, I lived in Atlanta for 13 years. I remember my kids coming home from school talking about the War of Northern Aggression, which I had no idea what they were talking about. I grew up in Michigan. It was called the Civil War in Michigan. And so that's why I think that we need Reconstruction. I think that we need to essentially reoccupy the South and say, we're going to take over your schools, and we're going to teach your kids the real history of the South and of the United States. And we're going to, you know, seize your legislatures, at least in part, and prevent you from preventing people from voting just because they're black or they're poor or they're elderly or they're young. And we're going to put this country back together again, damn it. Shannon, thank you for the call. Gary in Largo, Florida. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hey Tom, I can appreciate your thoughts on that, but I'd like to just mention that the Civil War in the South in spirit never ended, and
that's my point.
When we had that night, when we had the Brown versus Board that decision,
right.
That was looked upon as the Reconstruction, another Reconstruction, and we
in the South, when Bobby Kennedy sent troops, I mean this was a decade later, nearly a decade later, Bobby Kennedy sent troops down into Alabama and Georgia, and
then you get people like Ron Paul who will go and he'll go up in front of a bunch of university people and say, well, it was the Republicans that that freed the slaves, and this is a total. You can't analyze it like that.
No, it was the liberals who freed the slaves because the Republican Party in 1860 was a liberal party. It was a progressive party,
right.
It was the liberals who created the national park system. Teddy Roosevelt was a progressive Republican. So, yeah, you could say the Republicans did that, but the Republican Party changed big time under Nixon when they reached out for the Southern white racist vote.
Yeah, and I just want to mention one more thing, Tom, and I know you're pressed for time, but I predict that Donald Trump will not debate on August 6th. I don't think he, you know, I don't think he's that intelligent, and I don't think, you know, he's going to come across as a clown if he does, as much as.
It's going to be really interesting. I would not take that bet because I think you're right. I think the Republican Party is going to figure out a way to push Donald Trump out of the debate, or Fox so-called news might.
I mean, as much as I'd like to see it, I don't think he'll do it. But at any rate, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thank you very much, Bob in Sherman Oaks, California, the South.
The South. What we seem not to understand is, yes, they have all these right-wing Republican governors all over the South, but it's always surprising me when these cop incidents, cop killing black incidents happen, you find out the mayor is a Democrat. And when I lived in Miami while going to college, it was amazing that Democratic, that was a time in the 50s when the Democrats controlled the South.
Yeah, and then those were the Dixiecrats. Those were the racist white Democrats who basically left the party after Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act. And then Richard Nixon, you know, in 68, reached his arms out to them with his Southern strategy and said, come on in, you Southern white racist Democrats. We'll make you Republicans. And it worked.
Oh, so what I'd like to, I'm a substitute teacher in LAUSD, Los Angeles Unified School District.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, before I go off on that tangent, I'd like to say the two things where blacks have a tremendous amount of power that never gets organized in such a way as to take over the state is municipal.
Mm-hmm.
There's 45 black mayors, I think, covering many southern cities. Because inner cities throughout the South, including Atlanta and major cities, Oakland, et cetera, are black and elect black mayors.
Yeah.
If they started to use the black power as mayors of these cities and made sure the school supervisors were also black, because usually it's now Bill Gates, Eli Broad,
and they're doing charter schools. Like, you know, here in D.C., we got more charter schools than anywhere else in the country. It's crazy. Bob, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. I promised you we would also talk about Greece, although there's a bunch of people on the line still want to talk about the South, which is fine with me. We can do that all day. In fact, let me just add to this rant from the previous hour about how essentially the slavery history and the white racist, the ongoing presence of white supremacist movements and racist white folks in the South in a culture that accepts that. I remember when it is devastating this country. I mean, it's just it's a terrible thing. It's not good for America. I remember when we moved to Atlanta in 1983. And Louise, I flew down and I looked at a couple of houses with one real estate agent. And then Louise flew down and she looked at some houses with another real estate agent. And the first question this woman asked her was, do you want to live in a whites-only neighborhood or in a mixed neighborhood? And Louise's response was, I would like a different real estate agent. But that, I mean, you know, this is a true story. 1983. I don't know if it's still going on, but this from the Washington Post day before yesterday. No, yesterday. Today's the 7th. This is 7-7. That's a good set of numbers there. This fall, Texas, this by the editorial board of the Washington Post. This is the official position of the Washington Post. I'll just read a few sentences from it. You can find it over you know, WashingtonPost.com. This fall, Texas schools will teach students that Moses played a bigger role in inspiring our Constitution than slavery did in starting the Civil War. Seriously. By the way, Moses had nothing to do with inspiring our Constitution. Our laws are not based on the Ten Commandments. We don't stone our children to death when they talk back. We don't murder our neighbor if he worships a god other than our God. Which, by the way, is the first commandment. Anyhow, the Lone Star State's new social studies textbooks, deliberately written to play down slavery's role in Southern history, do not threaten only Texans. They pose a danger to school children all over the country. Why is that? That's because Texas is the second largest market behind California for textbooks. And so when they say to the big textbook companies, this is what we want, and those companies are trying to take a run of 100,000 books and turn it into a run of 500,000 books so that the costs go down so that they can then sell those books to all the other states around the country. Texas is one of the few states that sets standards like this as a state. This is the Texas State School Board came up with this. Moses played a bigger role in inspiring the Constitution than slavery did in starting the Civil War. It is alarming. The editorial board of the Washington Post writes, it is alarming that 150 years after the Civil War's end, children are learning that slavery was, as one Texas Board of Education member put it in 2010, a side issue. By distorting history, Texas tells its students a dishonest and damaging story about the United States that prevents children from understanding our country today. Texas is rare for the brazenly political way school board members devised its curriculum. Amen. Okay, so we can continue to talk about that. But I wanted to tell you about Greece. You ever hear of a guy named Robert Mundell? Greg Palast has been on this program. He's talked about him before. And there's a new op-ed I got in the mail from it's published over at Op-Ed News at Rob Call's site, opednews.com, by Michael Navratakis in Athens and Greg Palast in New York. I'm guessing it's over on Greg Palast's website too, gregpalast.com. So Professor Robert Mundell is the guy who invented the euro and suggested that all of these European countries should all use a common currency. Okay, so who is this guy? Who is Robert Mundell? Well, he's dead now. But Greg Palast, who, by the way, was trained in economics in college, Greg Palast knew him, interviewed him extensively. And here's what he has to say. It's important to mention that the little bastard spawned by the late Professor Mundell was supply-side economics, otherwise known as Reaganomics, Thatcherism, or simply voodoo economics. So Mundell invented Reaganomics, and he invented the euro. And then, what's his name? Michael Navratakis says, the imposition of the euro had one true goal, to end the European welfare state. Remember Reaganomics? The whole point of Reaganomics was to roll back the New Deal. And they're still working on it. They even got Bill Clinton to go along with it and end welfare as we know it. I mean, just roll back the New Deal. To hell with those poor people. To forget about giving people bootstraps to pull themselves up by. We have to give tax cuts to wealthy people and raise taxes and cut benefits for poor people. This is exactly what Sam Brownback is doing in Kansas and Scott Walker's doing in Wisconsin. And I mean, just pick your Republican state. And here's what Mundell, this was his vision. I'm quoting from this article. The euro itself would be the vector infecting the European body politic with supply-side Reaganomics. The vector is, you know, what carries disease, like mosquitoes are vectors for malaria. The euro itself would be the vector infecting the European body politic with supply-side Reaganomics. Mundell saw a euroed Europe as free of trade unions and government regulations, a Europe in which the votes of parliament were meaningless. Each eurozone nation, unable to control the value of its currency, unable to control its own budget, unable to control its own fiscal policy, could only compete for business by slashing taxes and regulations. Here's an absolute, here's a verbatim quote from Robert Mundell, the inventor of the euro. Quote, "The euro puts monetary policy out of the reach of politicians. Without fiscal policy, the only way nations can keep jobs is by the competitive reduction of rules on business." This is the religion of austerity that the Republican budget, which would slash $5.5 trillion of spending here in the United States and cut our GDP by 1% next year and almost 2% the following year, lay off millions of people next year, many millions more the following years. This is the budget that just passed the Republican House, right? Paul Ryan's wonderful budget. It's Reaganomics. It's the same thing Sam Brownback did to Kansas. Tax cuts for billionaires, cut any kind of benefits to poor people, you know, no minimum wage increase. I mean, it's just, it's insane. And this is also what Germany and what the Europeans, these neoliberals in Europe, have imposed on Greece and Spain and Italy and Portugal. And surprise, just like Reaganomics, it's not working. It's destroying the working class. It's destroying jobs. Unemployment in Greece is now where it was during World War II and World War I. I mean, there was a headline in one of the British newspapers a couple of days ago that said, you know, Greek economy now is similar to that when Greece was ravaged by war, right? It's worse than when it was a war economy. Greece was occupied by the Nazis. Germany, by the way, has never paid back the money to Greece that they owed them from World War II. Greece forgave the debt. Don't think they should have done that. But do you get it? It's like Reaganomics is, this is the corporate takeover of the world, the transnational corporate takeover of the world. The EU is like the TPP.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we want to jump into this full bore with both feet, right? I don't think so. And welcome back. Anne, watching Free Speech TV in Belfast, Maine. Anne, you were at the Bernie rally?
I was. I'm a longtime listener and a first-time caller, and it's an honor to speak to you.
Thank you.
I've learned so much. And I take what you say at the end of your show as a challenge, tag you're it. So I go to Tom school every day, and I appreciate you taking this call. So,
well,
yes, I was at the Bernie rally last night. I drove an hour and a half, and before we left, we asked a policeman, how many people do you think were in the auditorium? And he said 8,400.
Wow.
So I think they're downplaying it a bit, but
they always do.
The crowd was so energized and so friendly. All ages were there, lots of families with children. He had a huge audience reaction when he mentioned his comments about women's right to choose. Everybody jumped to their feet and applauded. It was energizing. And Portland, Maine is a progressive area. There's about 55,000 people that live there. The state is about 1.2 million-ish. And, yes, we do have a Tea Party governor that most of us are absolutely ashamed of.
Embarrassed by.
He's so right. I am so embarrassed. And during the election, LePage got 48.2% of the vote, and Michaud had 43.4, and there was a third-party candidate, Elliot Cutler, who took away 8.4%.
Right.
And after the election, LePage announced that he wanted to give Elliot Cutler a position as Attorney General. So most of us look at this and say, you know, he was...
Oh, that guy was in the race to knock out the Democrat.
Right, right. And I think that, I don't know, I talk to people and they think that because Michaud revealed that he was gay, that it caused him some harm. Although we do have a strong LGBT community and a marriage
right.
equality.
So they would vote for him rather than the Democrat. That would pull away enough votes that LePage ends up winning.
Correct. But, you know, if there's a positive side to this, the Republican representatives and senators in our state are vetoing things that LePage wants. So he's having a tough time, and he comes to conferences and meetings with the legislature. And
well, they're talking about impeaching him now, aren't they, Ann?
They are.
I mean, that's incredible.
Well, there was a Speaker of the House by the name of Mark Eaves applied for a job at Goodwill Hinckley. He has very good experience in the position that he was applying for. And when he was given the position, LePage wrote a letter to Goodwill Hinckley saying that Mark Eaves voted against charter schools and this and that. And he talked about withholding $500,000 to Goodwill Hinckley in the letter.
Yeah. Which is blackmail, isn't it?
Oh, that's what I see.
Yeah.
And so the committee that reviewed
for extortion or something.
Incident,
I mean, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, it's just horrible.
Yeah.
Anyway, the committee voted unanimously to look into it. They have no power for impeachment. And LePage is walking around laughing, going, they can't do anything.
Yeah. Oh, that's sad. Ann, thanks for the call. It's great to hear that Bernie had a great rally in Portland, Maine yesterday, though. That's incredible. Thank you, Ann. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So the Greek people, I had Mark Weisbrot on Center for Economic and Policy Research, as I recall, on our TV show last night. And he said that, and I've heard this, you know, from several people now, but I mean, he just stated it as a absolute fact that what the Greek crisis is about right now, the reason that the Europeans, the reason that the Eurozone and the relatively right-wing Angela Merkel is pushing to basically destroy Greece is because they want regime change. They are flipped out about the possibility that a socialist is now the prime minister of Greece, Alexis Tsipras. I mean, you know, essentially a democratic socialist. Oh, my God, we can't have that. Let's destroy the country economically, bring them to their knees. And the Greek people on Sunday said, no, we stand with him. But it's Thatcheronomics, Reaganomics migrated out of the UK and the United States into the Eurozone with the euro. And it was invented by the guy who invented Reaganomics and supply-side economics. Michael Mundell? Robert Mundell. What's his name here? Professor Robert Mundell. It's incredible. It's just incredible. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Yes, I wanted to make a couple of points. One on the Greece issue. I do think you're right. I do think we can, however, sort of distinguish between two ideas, let's hold two ideas in our heads at the same time. On the one hand, there's a lot of advantage to having a common currency in Europe. And we can separate that out from the supply-side economic theories that have been thoroughly debunked. And so, again, I think we can keep both of these concepts.
What is the advantage, Steve? Every single country that uses the common currency loses their own economic sovereignty.
Efficiency is increased tremendously. In other words, I don't have to go through this tremendous exchange process when I'm trying to buy something coming out of Germany.
But, Steve, efficiency is not intrinsically good.
Well, in this case, it certainly is. I mean, what is good about wasting time and having exchange rates that, again, delay the process, increase costs?
It is the cost of having national sovereignty.
So you're making the same argument that states' rights advocates are making in this country now.
No, because states are not trying to have their own currencies in this country. I'm not making that argument at all. I'm talking about national sovereignty.
It's the same principle. And by the way, that idea that somehow national sovereignty is completely usurped is a fallacy. The Greeks just proved that. So again, I'm not.
No, they haven't proved it. They are still under the thumb of the European Union, and they will be until they leave the euro and start issuing the drachma.
But that's exactly the point. And when they leave the European Union, they'll have to tremendously devalue their own currency.
Over the short term, you're right.
Part of this problem has to do with the fact that the Greeks have a system that is terrible at collecting taxes. You know, in this country,
that is not the problem, Steve. That there is
Paul Krugman, no, Steve, Paul Krugman talks about this extensively.
Steve, there is corruption and there is tax cheating in Greece. There is in the United States too. You've got some of the largest corporations in America who make billions, tens of billions of dollars a year in profits, who pay absolutely no taxes. And there are some rich people in Greece who don't pay any taxes. And there are people, you know, Rush Limbaugh was ranting about them yesterday. There's you know, some 800 people on some island who are claiming that they're blind when they're not. Big deal. That's not what's causing the problem. What's causing the problem is that Europe came in and said, you've got to impose austerity. You've got to cut back on the state sector. You've got to end your national health care program for anybody who's not employed after 1 year. You've got to dial back on your pension program, cut the money that goes basically Social Security, cut Social Security benefits in half. You've got to reduce wages. You've got to lay off 20-30% of your government workers. It's slash and burn Reaganomics. It's slash and burn Sam Brownback. And what it's devastated Kansas. It's devastating, you know, the red states in this country that are trying it. And it's devastated the United States over the last 30 years. And a sovereign nation should have the ability to control their own currency. And as Mundell said, you know, if we can just, well, here's the quote from him. He said, the euro puts monetary policy out of the reach of politicians. Without fiscal policy, the only way nations can keep jobs is by the competitive reduction of rules on businesses and taxes, reduction of taxes. And in other words, you lose your ability to control your own country. I don't think that efficiency is a god, Steve. For example, you've got a whole bunch of different health insurance companies right now that are all buying each other up. We're going to end up with three health insurance companies in the United States. It's going to be just like we have four airlines. You know, we have 11 companies that control 90% of the nation's media. We're going to end up with three health insurance companies. Robert Reich has a great piece about that today over at Huffington Post. A choice ahead: private health insurance monopoly or single payer. And yeah, it's going to make more efficiency. It's very simple. When Aetna buys Anthem, you know, for $47 billion, Aetna is buying Humana for $35 billion. Anthem is buying Cigna for $47 billion. Centene just acquired HealthNet for $6.3 billion. And then Anthem bought Healthcare Holdings for $800 million. Yeah, they're going to get more efficient. They're going to, you know, lay off half their bookkeeping staff, because now it's not two companies, it's one. They'll lay off half their marketing staff. They get more efficient. But that means that a lot of people are going to be unemployed, and these guys are going to have enough power in the marketplace to jack up the prices, which they've already told us they're going to do. They said, you know, next year, the rates are going to go up 20-30%. Why? Because we're looking at monopoly. Very efficient. We get screwed.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
28 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls right after this. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, this is sad news. Covington & Burlington is a law firm here, a big law firm, very wealthy, prosperous law firm here in Washington, D.C., that represents several of the big banks, major bankster representation. And Eric Holder worked there from, I think, 2001 to 2008. And then Barack Obama tapped him as attorney general, and he left Covington & Burlington. The National Law Journal had a headline that said Holder's return to Covington was 6 years in the making. He was making $2 million a year there. I don't know if he himself was defending banksters, but that's one of the big things that this law firm apparently does. And apparently they even kept an 11th floor corner office empty for his return, or at least made it empty. The article in Salon says, if we had a more aggressive media, this would be an enormous scandal. He's gone back to the law firm to defend more banksters after refusing to prosecute any banksters. It's sad. I hate to report stories like that. Angela in Lakeland, Florida. Hey, Angela, what's up?
Tom.
Yeah.
Thank you for your program, and thank you for always being there for us.
Sure, my pleasure.
I saw an interesting conversation recently, televised on Link TV, between John Nichols and Dr. Noam Chomsky.
Uh-huh.
The particular point that I wanted to make was this regarding Mr. Chomsky's address. In 1898, when the United States took over Cuba from Spain,
mm-hmm.
Spain insisted that the United States pay Cuba's debts. The United States argued against that request, stating that it was not the responsibility of the Cuban people to pay the debts of the Cuban rulers.
Okay.
Fast forward 125 years. Interesting that the United States has changed its tune and now feels that, yes, the United States people should pay the debts of its rulers. And that's what we did with the bailout in the United States in 2008,
right.
2009, 2010.
Right.
And the same thing is going on in Greece. The German banks, the Bundestag and Brussels bankers, they gambled. They made all these bad risks. And now they expect the people of Europe to pay for them. They expect Greece to pay for the debts of a bunch of just a small handful of people that made a lot of really, really bad decisions.
And a lot of money.
Not only made a lot of money, they destroyed lives.
Yeah, you're right.
In the process of making a lot of money, all they did was destroy lives, and they're not willing to concede a single point. The IMF, the ECB, none of them are even beginning to accept the reality that this is your problem.
Here's what's happening, Angela. All around the world, we are seeing the takeover of corporate power, the diminishing of democratic institutions, and the raising up of oligarchic, kleptocratic, and plutocratic institutions. And in China, for example, you've got state-run capitalism. So it's almost like neo-feudalism in a way. In Europe, they are slowly but surely, and Angela Merkel, has presided over some of this, taking apart the social welfare system that they had. And this has been, 20 years in the making in Germany. I'm very familiar with Germany, where they were just cutting back and cutting back and cutting back on the various things that the national healthcare system would pay for. And then even changing the national healthcare system, kind of fracturing it. And it's neoliberalism. It's the corporate takeover. We saw the same thing here in the United States in 1976. In 1971, Lewis Powell was put on the Supreme. In 71, first he wrote a memo to Eugene Sindor, his neighbor, who was the head of the Chamber of Commerce, saying, we business people have to. He was a lawyer at that time for J.P. Lorillard and others, and a tobacco lawyer. And he said, we need to gain political power, because Ralph Nader and Rachel Carlson have published these books and they've created an environmental movement and a consumer movement, and we're going to be in big political trouble if we don't start taking over political institutions. The next year, or a few months later, Richard Nixon put him on the Supreme Court. In 1976, he wrote the decision in Buckley versus Vallejo that said that the First Amendment protects the right of rich people to buy politicians. And that decision then was amplified 100 times by Citizens United. So we have plutocracy or oligarchy here in the United States, and it's growing. I mean, you've got two brothers announcing that they're going to spend $800 or $900 million to influence elections. There is no other word for that than plutocracy or aristocracy or oligarchy. And the same thing is happening in Europe with the Eurozone. It's the point of the euro, according to its inventor, Robert Mundell, the point of the euro was to force all these independent governments to give up their any kind of limitations on the activities of business and any kind of taxes, you know, or not all of the taxes, but to reduce the taxes on rich people and corporations. This we're watching right in front of us, and nobody's talking about it in these terms. We are watching the corporate takeover of basically what's left of the developed world. And what's replacing it increasingly is state-run capitalism, a.k.a. China, Vietnam, Brunei, Malaysia, Singapore. These are all basically they're state-run capitalist states. It's not true capitalism. It's monopoly capitalism. And here in the United States, we're seeing monopoly capitalism. So, yeah, I'm with you. Excellent point, Angela. Thank you for calling and making it. Bill in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hey, Bill, what's up? You wanted to talk about the South?
Oh, yes, sir. Really appreciate the show. First time caller. I have great respect for your acumen. You know it.
Thank you.
I just want to throw a couple of ideas out here. Yes, the idea about the South, I think it's a little bit more than that. We have to take care of things on a more social level, okay? A more homeopathic kind of level. I believe actually the issue might be reality. I'm going to explain myself. You remember the experiment that was done in 2012, or the Monopoly game that was done? Do you remember that one?
No.
Okay, it was done in California where they had, it was basically an experiment on social effects of privilege. Mm. They had one guy who would basically have twice as much money, have twice as many turns, and they would just sit back and watch his behavior. After 15 minutes, he started becoming a little bit annoying, and then got to the point where he would reach for the punt, you know, the little bowl where they had the snacks and everything. He would just grab it and basically start acting very entitled. This was after 15 minutes.
Right.
Now,
I've seen similar studies on how wealthy people tend to have less empathy for others.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I'm thinking what's happening socially is in the South, well, we need to do a couple of things first. First, we have to have the conversation on race. I'm sorry, we have to have it. And I think that one of the reasons why a lot of Caucasian folks don't want to have it is because to have the conversation opens them up to acknowledging there's a problem.
Did you say the conversation on race?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, I agree. And in particular, white people need to have a conversation about white privilege.
Exactly, because the whole idea of being on third base, saying that you hit the home run,
yeah.
Same thing. Now, if you take this and you add it to the folks in the South who basically, you know, been supported by the whole white supremacist meme, a lot of things get broken down. You want to know what we need to do? First, we have to take care of things socially and homeopathically, like I just mentioned, because we have to have the conversation or our world is done, because it even dovetails with Greece and other things going on in the world, because this same class of people have been running things for a long time, and they are basically removed from reality. That's what I believe. So a lot of problems in the world come from this. Now, we take care of the first problem, doing it homeopathically. Then, when it comes to physically doing something, I think the Department of Justice just needs to come down in the South and just investigate. Everything is not nailed down.
Yeah.
Police shootings, court activities, how the schools are run. I mean, let's face it, the charter school thing, pretty much as far as I've read, has pretty much resegregated the schools back to pre.
It has, and it's a scam. Charter schools do not perform better than public schools on average. In fact, they perform worse, plus the for-profit charter schools perform worse of the worse. Yeah, it's just a scam. It's just a way of taking the public good, the commons, and turning it into a cash cow for somebody, which is, of course, something that a Republican would embrace. Make a buck off something? No, go ahead. I was being rhetorical.
Oh, sorry. So basically, got the list of things here. Housing, everything going on down here, it has to be handled. I live in downtown St. Petersburg, and it's going through a massive gentrification project.
Right.
Every place where there's an open lot, they're building overpriced condos. And, of course, the usual suspects are allowed to come in. The usual suspects are saying, oh, we've sold everything out. You know,
yeah.
I've gone through that myself, being African-American. Now, one of the other contributing factors to what we're discussing in the South and basically a lot of things going on in the country is the media.
Mm.
One of the problems we have with racism is, one, we're not actually discussing the problem of racism or having the conversation. And two, Fox News. let's be honest. The folks on the right, basically, it's almost like they're creating more racism than they were in the beginning. We are moving forward in a country pretty well when it came to race relations, you know, lies are showing the different places. And then suddenly Reagan came along and everything came to a screeching halt.
Yep.
And I think they've done great damage to the world. And I know we're coming up to the bumper here. The new word that you were talking about for describing the country is neo-feudal corporate oligarchy. That's what I think is going on.
There you go. I think you're right. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Neo-feudal corporate oligarchy. Bill's nailed it. We'll be back. Welcome back. Jill in Princeton, Minnesota. Hey, Jill, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Let me be frank. I believe that the way to help the South, and we only have a few months to do this, is for the blue states to reach out to them and let them know we have one man who is representing what most of Americans want. And by the way, probably what most of the world would like to have see for their countries. And that is our job as the blue states to get out in whatever way you can and help them understand we have a way already in place and we only have a few short months.
And is that Bernie you're talking about?
That's Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. Bernie has, in the last couple months, he's been down to South Carolina. He's been in several southern states. I think this is before he announced that he was running for president. And he wasn't drawing, 5,000 people, 10,000 people at a whack, but he was drawing hundreds, just as the senator from Vermont. And I suspect, and I know that Bernie is going to be going through the South. He's going to be campaigning aggressively in the South. So.
Yeah, I don't think it's just Bernie, because Bernie can't do it alone. It's the people in the blue states who realize what true democracy can be like. And even be better with Bernie.
Yeah.
We need those voices to, in whatever way, reach out to, anyone, not just the South.
Right. And also, Bernie needs, or we need to communicate, actually I think Bernie and his campaign need to communicate this too, to African Americans in the South, well, all across the country really, but particularly in the South, that he's been with them forever. I mean, he started his political career as a college student at the University of Chicago, getting arrested with Congress on Racial Equality, trying to integrate student housing at the University of Chicago and other housing. Then in 1988, I didn't know this until today. The Salon just came out with this article, the truth about Bernie Sanders and race, why his biggest weakness could become his greatest strength. And it says, a good place to start, they're talking about Sanders on race and how people don't know, right? A good place to start, rather than the last month and a half of primary campaigning, might be 1988, a pivotal point in the Democratic Party, which would lose the presidential contest that year and embark on two divergent paths. A month before the Vermont primary in 1988, Burlington Mayor Bernie Sanders took to the podium to deliver his signature impassioned earnestness to introduce presidential candidate Reverend Jesse Jackson to the stage in that state's biggest city. Sanders championed Jackson's multiracial, multi-issue rainbow coalition and deployed his white privilege, Sanders's, to convince the whitest state in the union that Jesse Jackson should be president. Bernie delivered, adding the 95% white Vermont to the 10 other primary contests that Jesse Jackson would take from the eventual nominee, Michael Dukakis. He's been there all along.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So, I mean,
Now, let's say, God forbid, we got a Republican as president in 2016. In my view, lights are out for America.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's like right back to 1890. If that happened. I mean, it's just, there's... Jill, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Bob Ney will be with us. T- 10 minutes before the hour. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And by the way, exciting stuff happening in both places. Let's check in with Bob Ney, the author of Sideswiped, the real story of how Washington, D.C. works. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom.
So what's up in the world today?
Well, if we could, let's go overseas first. We'll go to the issue of Iran.
Okay.
Now, it's once again been delayed, but that doesn't mean that the deal's dead. Something interesting, a press release came in the middle of the night via email from Senator from Tennessee, Corker. And he is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Tom, as you know.
Right.
And a Republican, in there, he urged the president, don't rush on a deal. Mm-hmm. Get a good deal,
mm-hmm.
which is not what he's obviously said before. There was no good deal.
Right.
The reason he said that is because they took the resolution they sent the president. They altered it. Really, the president won on that resolution, although the Republicans said they took the lead. And if the deadline is met, which would be actually the 9th of July,
mm-hmm.
the Senate only has 30 days to go over that resolution. If it comes on the 10th, then they have 60 days to go over it.
Which means not only does the Senate have 60 days, but the two major sources of foreign money that is coming into the United States to run advertisements against the deal with Iran are coming out of Israel and Saudi Arabia, two countries that are totally freaked out that we might normalize relations with Iran.
That's correct, and they will spend a fortune into the coffers of candidates, but also they'll spend a lot of money on television advertisements.
Right, and if they've got 60 days to do it, that might be enough to really flip things badly. 30 days is bad enough.
Well, that's correct. But, you know, this case, Corker can't blame the president. This resolution came from a Republican-controlled Senate and a Republican-controlled House.
Hmm.
So it'll be very interesting to see what happens.
Yeah.
They actually crossed themselves over on this resolution when they did it.
Yeah. You speak Farsi, you know Iran. You were the only member of Congress who had that kind of insight and knowledge. How do you think this is going to shake out?
I think we're going to get a deal because if you look at the history of Iran, no one has stopped Iran in 30-some years of progressing towards a bomb. The Bush administration had a wonderful chance when they received an overture from the highest levels, which during the Bush administration would have put American inspectors physically on the ground of Iran.
That was an offer from Iran that you personally delivered to the Bush administration, which led to their going after you. Am I remembering right?
Yes. It was brought to me by the ambassador from Switzerland to Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
He came to my office. He wanted to make sure the right eyes got it. I sent it to Karl Rove. It was denied that they ever received it. The late Tony Snow, the press secretary at the time, said, well, look at Bob Ney and look where he's at. He's in prison.
Right.
And that they never received it. Later on, Colin Powell's former chief of staff acknowledged that Condoleezza Rice had seen it and that they all saw it.
Wow.
They had an opportunity to do something. As I'm told on the inside, Dick Cheney won the argument that this would not be agreed to. We would have had inspectors on the ground years ago.
Wow. Okay, so you think that they're it seems to me like, you know, the Ayatollah is Ayatollah Khamenei, who's the real power in Iran, it just really wants to get on with bringing his country back into the League of Nations, as it were.
Yes, and you have a new president, Rouhani. Now, that doesn't mean we have to completely agree or trust the Iranians, but I would point out, just as we have Senator Cotton, who would do anything to sabotage this deal, among some other senators, they have conservative ayatollahs in Iran who absolutely do not want a deal. They will continue with a bomb, and they don't want to go back into the Western world.
Hmm.
So that's on both sides. But this is a legacy, and some of the Republicans won't go along with it strictly because it's President Obama doing something that nobody's been able to do in 30 years, which is to actually make Iran accountable.
Right. You know what makes me crazy is I've been seeing some of these ads on TV against this deal, and they say President Obama's deal will allow Iran to continue to maintain their nuclear capacity. Well, they have nuclear power plants. And that's the, you know, they never say bombs, right? The nuclear bomb capacity. They say nuclear capacity. And it's just so disingenuous, Bob. It makes me crazy.
Well, I also saw the ads yesterday. And, of course, who's on the ad? Senator Rubio will step up to the plate. It's a Rubio paid ad going around the lot.
Oh, wow.
For president. Oh, they've actually got his picture on there and said, Senator Rubio is standing up to President Obama.
Oh, no.
So,
so now it's
political ad that goes around the money.
So what else is going on in the world?
Well, the other issue, of course, is the is Greece and what's going to happen there. President Obama's called the prime minister. Our president's urging some type of middle ground between the EU and Greece. So we'll see what develops yet.
Yeah.
I think one of the most amazing stories I've looked at today, Tom, is Eric Holder's comments on Edward Snowden.
Yeah, that was remarkable. Tell us about that. I haven't talked about it on the air.
Eric Holder has made a statement that, after all, now he didn't say that Snowden was a great, great guy, but he said, after all, he brought some issues to the forefront that would have not been discussed or have not been talked about.
Right, and he said words to the effect of, it was an important conversation that we had as a consequence of what Snowden did, and so maybe we could work something out to bring him back.
That's right, and he's made that statement. Now, the Justice Department's not commenting, but we know there's some comments being made and some communications with Snowden's attorneys and has been going on for a while.
That's very interesting. I mean, he's no longer Attorney General. So. Yeah, yeah.
And of course, the inside Hill conspiracy theory, Tom, is that Snowden has something that the government really doesn't want told.
Oh, he hasn't. He has not yet dropped the big kahuna.
Exactly. The big one.
Yeah. Huh. Right. Interesting.
And the only other news of the day that is hitting from the Hill is the fact that Ash Carter, our defense secretary, was up on Capitol Hill. John McCain's going wild because the president's not doing enough in Syria or Iraq. And, of course, they missed the boat that the fact that the Bush administration dismantled the whole military over there.
We need more wars, more bombs, Bob.
That's right, yeah. From John McCain's point of view.
Right, exactly. Never saw a war he didn't like. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, author of Sideswiped. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Always great to see you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And it seems that there's, oh yeah, Jeb Bush's South Korean sugar daddy and Bernie Sanders in the American mainstream. And I shared with you the Donald Trump Twitter war. That was hysterical. Jeb Bush left the governorship in Florida worth a little over $1 million. Not bad. And of course, he's the heir to a major fortune, but he's got to wait for his daddy to die before that money comes to him, and his father and his mother. But he made himself some $20 or $30 million over the course. I think it's $29 million is the amount that is most frequently quoted over the course of the years since he was the governor of Florida, where, by the way, in 2000, he knocked 80,000 African-American voters off the voting rolls just weeks before the election in 2000, so that his brother, George W. Bush, could get within stealing distance of the race. But even with that, it took the Supreme Court to give the presidency to George W. Bush. We didn't find out for a year until a year later, when the New York Times actually counted the ballots, that had the Florida Supreme Court, which ordered that every ballot be recounted in the state, not been stopped by the U.S. Supreme Court, that Al Gore actually got more votes in Florida than George W. Bush did, carried the state, and was the actual legitimate president of the United States. That's the legacy that I think is the most important piece of Jeb Bush's legacy, is that he helped his brother steal an election by disenfranchising African Americans in Florida and doing it in just a really sleazy way, you know, with a felon list from the state of Texas where his brother had been governor, by the way. But here it gets even weirder. Politico has a piece by Ken Vogel, who's a damn good writer, by the way, Kenneth Vogel. It's called Jeb Bush's Jeb's South Korean Sugar Daddy. Every time I see a J-E-B sign, you know, is it Jeb exclamation mark? I think because it's supposed to stand for John. What's his middle name? It's not Edward. I don't know what the E is. But it's John something Bush. His real name isn't Jeb, it's John. But John Ellis Bush, thank you. But, you know, he doesn't, his brother really ruined the Bush name. And I would say his father did too. You know, the original invasion of Iraq in 1991, Bernie Sanders voted against it and made a speech on the floor of the House of Representatives warning us that this invasion would set up years of wars in the Middle East. And he was, of course, absolutely right. But anyhow, Jeb, as he amassed wealth, reading from Ken Vogel's piece here in Politico, as he amassed wealth after leaving the Florida governor's office, Jeb Bush delivered 10 separate paid speeches to a South Korean metal company that won more than $1 billion in contracts from his brother's presidential administration, according to disclosures released Tuesday. See, I keep telling you, the best investment that you can make in the United States, and there should be an exchange-traded fund. I would love to be able to take my retirement money and put it into an ETF like this. Is like, we're going to do an ETF, an exchange-traded fund, where we're going to buy politicians. We could do a Democratic one and a Republican one, right? And, you know, we're just going to invest in politicians on behalf of big corporations, and then we will encourage those politicians to vote in particular ways that will make money for those corporations. And those corporations, instead of kicking back to the politicians like they normally do, they will kick back to the ETF. I still have to work the bugs out. It doesn't quite yet make sense, but the best investment in America right now is to buy a politician because they're cheap. I mean, John Boehner got about $5 million for pushing through Fast Track. That's nothing. Fast Track is going to be worth trillions, hundreds of billions in profits. Kevin McCarthy got what, $3 million for pushing through Fast Track? Most of these, you know, the most of the Democrats, the 24, 28 Democrats who voted for the Fast Track, got just a few hundred thousand dollars to do it. I mean, investing in politicians is so cheap. Jeb Bush is only trying to get to be worth $30 million. And his company gives him $1 million to give a speech while his brother is president, and then his brother awards a $1 billion contract to that company. Sweet work, right? Poonsang Corporation. The company, Poonsang Corp, it's a South Korean company. And it's not even like he's like, you know, hey, let's take $1 billion of U.S. money and give it to an American company to do so. No, let's give it to a South Korean company. They're willing to give Jeb $1 million. The company Poonsang Corp and its CEO Jin Roy Ryu have been generous patrons of the Bush family over the years, raising about $1 million for the presidential library of Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, while also helping to organize trips to South Korea for Jeb and his presidential relatives. Jeb also worked as an advisor for the investment bank Lehman Brothers, which paid him $1.3 million a year before, drumroll, what happened to Lehman Brothers? With Jeb Bush's brilliant advice that he was paid $1.3 million a year for, they went bankrupt and they started the crash, the great crash of 2008 that happened while his brother was president. It's amazing. Among the entities that paid Bush to speak were dozens of nonprofits, from schools like Cornell to the Mortgage Bankers Association. For the companies on that list, such as pharmaceutical giant Pfizer or a handful of financial firms, landing a Bush speech offers the prospect of access to a powerful political family and the prestige that comes with it. That's especially true for foreign companies like the Indian newspaper publisher HT Media Limited. It paid for Bush to speak in 2007 at the tail end of his brother's presidency at a leadership summit in New Delhi where Bush was asked multiple times about U.S. foreign policy. According to the Indian news agency, quote, "This is the life of being the brother of the president." Soon after a speech to Poon Sang, this was 4 months after he left the governor's office, soon after that speech, writes Kenneth Vogel, a Poon Sang subsidiary called PMX that has headquarters in Iowa. You know, hey, if you want to create jobs someplace in America, do it in an early primary state, right? Where then First Lady Barbara Bush had cut the ribbon in 1992. This Poon Sang subsidiary called PMX won a $1 billion contract to supply coin metal to the U.S. Mint over objections from advocates for U.S. manufacturers. Pull those coins out of your pocket and look at them. The metal came from South Korea because Jeb Bush connected this company to his brother, whose administration hired them to provide the, you know, instead of using American metal for our coins, we're using South Korean metal? Really? Because Jeb wanted to make some money? In addition to the coins, by the way, Poon Sang manufactures ammunition, Ken Vogel writes, including landmines and cluster bombs that have run afoul of international human rights standards. Wonderful people the Bushes hang out with, isn't it? It's amazing. It's just amazing. So what are we going to do about the South? What are we going to do about Greece? What are we going to do about this Thatcherism, Reaganism, supply-side economics, voodoo economics, which has not only infected the Republican Party in the United States and much of the United States, even some Democrats, but has also now infected Europe? I mean, it started with Thatcher. That's, you know, in the UK's part of Europe. And now it's taking down Greece.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, the euro was invented by the same guy who invented Reaganomics. And it was put there to lower taxes and cut regulations. Welcome back. Let's see here. James in Spokane, Washington, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, James, what's on your mind? James, can you hear me? James may be muted. Tammy in Spirit Lake, Iowa. Hey, Tammy, watching Free Speech TV. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. You're on the air.
Oh, awesome, Tom. Hey, I wanted to kind of take it back to the Willie Horton moment because, you know, here in Iowa, we have murders occurring by white guys who are influenced by, you know, things like the Confederate flag and the NRA, but we're not hearing about those. You know, Steve King is backing Donald Trump's horrible and racist.
Oh, Steve King, the cantaloupe thighs guy?
Yes, yes. You know, and I did a little research, and apparently he's got the second highest number of immigrants in the state of Iowa. Over 46,000 of them live in his district alone. So, you know, I really think if he wants to deal with that issue, he probably should look at the CAFO operators. You know, and the bird flu, a lot of people think the bird flu may have come because they, you know, they hop in vans and go from one to the other catching chickens. And, I mean, it's just madness. But, you know, the murders, we've had two recent murders of, you know, one was an 18-year-old kid killing a 19-year-old kid, white kids. Mm-hmm. The other was a young man who killed a white girl in a mall, and she had previously complained that he was sexually harassing her. But yet, you know, again,
he was a white kid too.
Exactly. And according to, you know, he was, according to his Facebook page, he was into all of those, you know, what I consider terrorism, only because they're white, they're not, you know, they're not considered terrorists.
So they were into, like, the Patriot movement, the militia movement.
Yes, the NRA, the Confederate flag, all of that. They've got, you know, the guns, can't take my guns,
right.
You know, blah, blah, blah. You know the
cold
the
dead
narrative
fingers
that they're putting out there.
Yep.
So I just wanted to, you know, kind of bring that to your attention. I did go see Bernie, by the way. He's fabulous, and he's really generating a lot of interest here, even in Steve King's district. So go.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Where where is Spirit Lake relative to where you saw him? How far did you have to travel?
Well, he hasn't been here yet. We're hoping so much he can get here because, but he has gone. I saw him in Fort Dodge the day after his Madison speech.
Mm-hmm.
The place was packed, and he asked us questions, which was fascinating. And then,
for example,
I was interviewed by he asked us how we felt about things instead of instead of delivering us like, and people would shout out, well, that's, you know, we're being like, how do you feel about the fact that the Koch brothers can spend this? Well, that sounds like we're being fooled. You know, I mean, people,
right.
The responses were incredible.
Yeah.
Then apparently he went to Sheldon the next morning, which is very, very Steve King.
Very conservative.
And he, extremely. And he really generated interest. I mean, people are, I mean, it won't be surprising to see Bernie and Steve King signs in the same yard. I'm just going to put it that way.
Yeah. Well, that's what I saw when I lived in Vermont, was George W. Bush for president, Bernie Sanders for Congress signs over and over and over and over again. And, you know, Bernie won Vermont with 74% of the vote. And, you know, no president, no Democrat for president has ever done that. Tammy, thank you for the call. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you and Karen in Auburndale, Florida. Hey, Karen, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Karen.
Keeping up an obvious Florida theme here today, I just called because I wanted to share a little part of a response email I received from Senator Marco Rubio regarding an email I had sent him about the carbon, the EPA and the carbon release from the power plant.
Mm-hmm.
And part of this response is, there is no question that the Earth's climate is changing just as it always has. However, there's a healthy scientific debate about how much human activity is contributing to that change.
That's a lie.
As a policymaker, I have a responsibility to consider the cost and benefits of proposed policies and regulations so that we can protect public safety and preserve the environment for future generations while not bringing undue economic pain to our economy.
Especially to the Koch brothers.
Regulations that seek to limit climate change, unilateral action by the United States to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is a costly gesture that slows economic growth, destroys jobs, increases energy prices, and does nothing to impact climate change.
Amazing. Amazing. You know what these guys are all, the reason why they're all doing this climate denial stuff is they want the Koch brothers' money. I mean, the Koch brothers are fossil fuel barons. They became billionaires. You know, their daddy made a fortune drilling oil for Joe Stalin, and they inherited this fortune from their dad. You know, it was exclusively an oil industry, I believe, early on. Now they bought Georgia Pacific and all these other companies, and now it's, you know, Koch Industries.
In the South, where we have public supermarkets, the big laugh to me is public supermarkets sells GreenWise products, which are recycled paper products. And I know my son is in his 30s, and he and all of his friends buy those. They're very conscious of the environment, and those products are manufactured by the Koch brothers.
Oh, my. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean,
but,
you know, the
but they're the ones who are funding the Republicans, and I think it's a fairly safe bet that any Republican who is denying climate change is doing so in part because either they don't want to get attacked by or they want money from, you know, Americans for Prosperity and all these other front groups that the Koch brothers fund. And that's so sad to hear Marco Rubio just lying to your face like that. Can you imagine the disaster for this country it would be if this shill for the billionaires in the fossil fuel industry were to become president?
I know.
It would
be with the governor that we have. I'm used to being lied to all the time, so it's just part of being a Floridian.
Well, you know? Yeah.
I love Bernie Sanders because it's who he is about and not what he has.
Yeah.
And I just hope that, I mean, I am trying to promote him to everyone I possibly can.
He's also one of the few people in the United States Senate who's not a millionaire.
he's a very self-aware person, and he has a lot of empathy for others, and
yep.
that's what we need in this country.
Yep. Bernie is who Bernie has always been. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I said thank you for letting me share that email from Senator Rubio. I just
that's fine.
Other people, that's from his mouth directly. So.
Okay. Karen, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for watching us on live stream. Jim in Crescent City, California, listening on KGEO. Hey, Jim, what's up? $10 bill? Jim can't hear me? Jim may have his phone muted. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, what's up?
So many things to talk about, but the reason I called in was the bashing on the South. I mean, yeah, the South deserves to take its share of lumps, but I've lived both in the South and in the North. In fact, I graduated high school out on Long Island, and I would submit that people up North are every bit as racist and, you know, in fact, many of them are even more virulent about it than I've ever met in the South.
I agree. I agree. I absolutely agree. That said, the social and economic policies in the North, by and large, in particular in the blue states, are more progressive and, you know, more like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, arguably UK. And
on paper, yes. But,
and in the South, you've got states that won't even expand Medicaid.
Yeah, but you go to, like, say, Long Island or Boston. You know,
right. Oh, there's plenty of racism
exactly
up there.
Where the black neighborhoods are and the white neighborhoods, you know. In Darlington, South Carolina, I don't think you could buy a house that doesn't have a black family living on that block.
Yeah, I think there's probably far more integration in the South than there is in the North. And large chunks of the North are just lily white. I mean, New Hampshire, Vermont, Wisconsin, Minnesota. These are very, very Iowa, very white states. But, my point earlier, and if you think I was bashing the South, well, I guess I was bashing the South. What I'm bashing is the vestige of plantation/concentration camp thinking that the South seceded from the Union to protect. And that includes keeping labor prices low, keeping workers disempowered, and locking people out of the political process. And that's epidemic in the South. Chris, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
That said, racism is not a Southern problem. It's an American problem. We'll be back. Tom Hartman here with you, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy while helping you win the water cooler wars. Doris in Palatine, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Doris, what's up?
Well, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And when I spoke with your screener, I was giving a lot of stuff, and I finally narrowed it down to one, or with her help, I have to tell you that. Pensions.
Mm-hmm.
In Illinois, we have been kicking the can down the road for years, and now the Chicago Teachers Union has to pay, which they have, which of money that they don't all have, a full, they don't have a full bank account to pay it, and they're going to have to lay off 1,400 people, which, of course, are teachers generally. And the nice little governor we have here is saying to the legislature, first of all, we don't have a budget. We're non-budget running
mm-hmm.
situation here. I'm not going to talk to you until you get some reforms done. So there is absolutely no give, and the teachers and the children, and it's the Chicago school, I went to Chicago schools until I was a junior, and then my family moved out of Chicago. But, I mean, I just can't imagine not having a decent school system, because if it isn't education for our kids, we're not going to go nowhere, no way. Yeah. No yeah. how. Yeah. And I just really can't understand how we have a legislature which is led by Democrats, both the House and the Senate.
Right, but you have a Republican governor. So
and it's going to be his way or no way, and his reforms are what he wants first. And we're talking pensions, people that paid into this, and the state was supposed to match, and they haven't been doing it. They've been borrowing from the funds, and right. now we're at a point where they may not be getting their pensions. We are not even getting paid because we don't have a budget yet. So it's just absolutely ridiculous, and people have got to wake up and realize this guy has been running ads with some of his campaign money against the Speaker of the House on how, you know, it's all the Democrats' fault that we're in this situation. We're having as much trouble as Wisconsin is, and we have a Democratic General Assembly, but that doesn't seem to work if the governor's just going to stand put and say, it's my way or the
highway.
Well,
and this didn't happen overnight, Doris.
No,
you've had either two or three governors, and I think they were all Democrats, go to prison. And,
right.
You know, political corruption is not unique to the Republican Party.
And to Illinois either, and I guess, and I saw a study that we are one of the top, and I thought, yeah. Oh, wonderful, you know,
yeah.
that's just really going to have people want to come in and live and build and.
Well, in a big way, it's kind of the legacy of Prohibition. You know, Prohibition.
Oh, yeah.
Al Capone ran that town. My dad grew up in the South Side of Chicago in the mm-hmm. 30s during Prohibition. He used to tell me stories about sitting on the stoop of the brownstone, you know, the row, the apartment row houses, you know.
Right.
It's an area that is now probably 100% African American. Back then it was a Norwegian immigrant ghetto, and he would sit on the steps and with his dad and his uncles, and he was the one that they had take the pail, the bucket, down to the speakeasy, you know, that Al Capone or whatever, whoever the guys were. There's another famous mobster who ran the liquor business there, and I might be mixing their names up. But anyhow, he was like 7 years old, you know, and he would go down and fill up the bucket with beer and bring it back and you know, serve it to his dad and his uncles, and as they sat there out the front steps in the summer. And mm-hmm. and it was like, you know, the cops didn't run the town. The during Prohibition, it was the mob, and basically
right.
the mob kind of morphed into the political machine, which morphed
right.
into the Daily Machine, which mm-hmm. morphed into. And I this is probably a very imperfect history of Chicago. I mean, I grew up in Michigan nearby, spent a lot of time in Chicago, and my dad moved to Michigan when he was 13 or 14, it just, you know, there's been a long history of corruption in that state. It's really unfortunate.
Right. And the thing of it is, when you look at what Abraham Lincoln was able to do, obviously, and to his death, to keep the union, I mean, keep the states together
mm-hmm.
and not let them split. And then you think, yeah, there have been three Democratic governors, of whom one has just been released and out. He's totally off of home confinement or close.
Blagojevich?
Ryan.
Oh.
And Blago is still in prison.
He's still in prison.
Yeah, well, it was Kerner was the
yeah.
other one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it just really, it seems to me that we can't go forward without going backwards five or six steps because of all the money that is being thrown around. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, and now we're going to be hurting our kids, and that to me is just the saddest thing, because if we can't put our money in the kids, meaning education and home and food, et cetera, we're not going to have a generation of people.
This is one of the number one things that I think should be the Democratic Party platform.
Yes.
It's the only candidate who is speaking out forcibly about it right now is Senator Sanders. I'm hoping that Hillary Clinton will step up. And that's getting money out of politics and going to publicly funded elections. And, you know, closing the revolving door in not just Washington, D.C., but in Illinois and every place else. And putting basically a firewall between private industry and the people's business, you know, and governance.
Right.
Doris,
right.
Thank you for the call. I got to move along, but thank you very much
You're
for
welcome.
The call.
You're welcome. Bye.
And thanks for listening to WCPT. Drew in Olathe, Kansas. Am I saying it right, Drew?
Olathe.
Okay. What's up?
Well, I wanted to talk about this whole election coming up and just basically how the Internet has allowed Bernie to be on equal footing going against Hillary Clinton.
And then same with Barack Obama, by the way, you know, in 2008 when he first ran his Internet operation. Well, and when he ran for reelection, you know, again in 2012. In fact, the company that did Obama's Internet stuff is now doing it for Bernie, just FYI. But back to you. I'm sorry.
Well, the thing is that I see with Hillary coming up, and we've got all this money in politics. You know, Bernie's got $15 million so far. I think Hillary's got 45, and the Internet's this great equalizer. I think if Hillary gets in, we'll end up getting someone in the FCC who will be kind of just getting rid of net neutrality or just basically pushing it to the side.
You don't know that, Drew. Hillary has not made a... to the best of my knowledge, has not made a policy statement about net neutrality, or has she? Do you know something I don't?
No. Well, I'll rephrase, rather. I feel that they don't want another Bernie Sanders coming up if Hillary wins, and they would rather shut the door on the Internet, I think, and basically put a bunch of gatekeepers at the front, as it were.
Well, it's not. I don't think it's about shutting doors and having gatekeepers. I think it's about money. I think, you know, you've got a rapid consolidation happening here in the United States among Internet service providers with, you know, the Comcast Time Warner merger and, you know, the ones that preceded that, actually, Comcast and NBC.
You know what Verizon had said, the interview back in Wall Street Journal or New York Times?
No.
They said we have the right to express or we believe we have the right to express editorial discretion. On your opinions, basically.
Whoa.
Yeah, so this is why I won't go near Verizon, for example. I won't touch them with the 10-foot pole. With that type of attitude, no, you're not a newspaper. You're just providing me access to the Internet. So.
Right. Yeah, Internet service providers should be absolutely neutral. I mean, that's the essence of net neutrality. I agree that Bernie is on the record and, you know, and has aggressively fought SOPA and PIPA and all the efforts to lock down the Internet or turn it over to private corporate interests in a way that, you know, I mean, the dream of companies like Comcast and Verizon and AT&T, the absolute dream that they have is that they can convert the Internet into a cable TV model.
I totally agree.
You know, they can say, oh, you want the news channel, you know, you want basic Internet, that's $35 a month. If you want the news channels, which includes 35 or 50 newspapers and a couple of TV sites, that's an extra $15 a month. You want Netflix, that's going to be, you know, a streaming video of any kind. It's going to be an extra YouTube. It's going to be an extra $15 a month. You want to go to the porn sites, that's an extra $40 a month, you know, because that's about half the traffic on the Internet outside of Facebook. And you want Facebook? Well, that's an extra $10 a month. You know, they'll slice and dice it just like they do cable TV. And in fact, you know, they're pretty open about that. You know.
Yeah, and as part of that, I would also just give people a heads up if anything starts to go that way. I don't know if you've heard of MeshNet, Tom.
I haven't.
It's basically a decentralized type of internet, but it's basically designed to prevent this and giving you access as a consumer to this stuff. I don't know exactly the proper way it's going to work, but yeah, just in case things go that way, people just look up MeshNet.
Okay, I'll have to check it out. Thank you, Drew.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Great to hear from you. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
Your
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Wow, great calls coming up. Substance abuse, 14th Amendment, Abraham Lincoln, average German people. Stick around.
Welcome back. James in Spokane, Washington. Hey, James, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, by the way.
Happy. Can you hear me now?
I can, just fine. Thank you for calling back.
Okay. Concerning the poor people anywhere in the world, but if we want to go national, let's say USA, we need to unilateralize substance abuse.
What does that mean?
Lock them up for drink. Lock them up for drinking, but let them use what they want until they break the law. The war on drugs is oppressing the poor people in this country and the world for the last 50 years, more than anything else directly.
Yeah, it's more than 50 years. I mean, it goes back to the 1930s. But, yeah, I agree.
Sure. It's a global hardship. Another point, Cuba going back with their relations with the USA, a great idea, but it ain't going to happen. We're not going to give them Guantanamo back, and they're insisting on it.
Well, they're not making that a deal breaker. They're saying this is on our list, but it's on our wish list after we normalize relations.
They should demand it.
I don't disagree with you, but you know it's going to require congressional action, and it ain't going to happen with this Congress, and they don't want to wait until the next president comes along, because that next president might be a Republican who will not normalize relations with Cuba. So they're going to do everything they can to cut this deal with Obama right now, even though it won't mean them getting everything that they can.
And quickly, Europe is a test kitchen. If we don't object to what they're doing there now, you know it's a test kitchen. They're going to bring it here.
Well, we already have it here. I mean, Sam Brownback is doing the same thing to Kansas that the Germans are doing to Greece.
Thank you. And if it works in Europe, whatever they do, if it works in Europe, it'll be here.
Yeah, and by the way, their definition of works is very different than yours or mine might be. What Sam Brownback has done is he's cut taxes like to zero for billionaires and multimillionaires in Kansas, state income taxes and whatnot. And he has raised taxes on working people in Kansas, and so that the average working person, you know, lower income working person is paying like 12-15% of their income in taxes. The average rich person is paying less than 3%, because basically he's raised the sales tax and he created giant loopholes on the income tax. So if you take your money as carry through from a corporation, as the Koch brothers and others who live in Kansas do. And it created this giant budget hole. And so what is he? He's cutting hundreds of millions of dollars of funding from the schools. He's cutting funding from welfare programs. Yeah, I mean, it's insane. I mean, Kansas is becoming Greece. But he considers that a success. I had two Republicans on TV last night defending it, saying he's had a very successful time. He got reelected, didn't you know? And I'm like, yeah, with lots of, you know.
Excuse me a minute.
Yes, sir.
A small question off the subject. I'm just wondering, you talk as if you're a nationalist, and I can understand it to a certain degree if you are. But let me ask you, do you think Jesus Christ recognized national boundaries? Do you think he was a nationalist?
I have no idea. I think that...
Take your best guess.
My best guess would be yes, actually, because he identified as a Jew, and... there was a big effort to create a Jewish state at that time, you know, because the country was occupied by Caesar, by Rome. So, but I'm not Jesus, so I'm not, and I'm not trying to be Jesus. And I will tell you, I am a nationalist, James. I think there's good nationalism and bad nationalism. But I consider myself a nationalist. If you think that's bad, call some other time and we will debate it. I would love to have a discussion on it. Thanks a lot for the call. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Judy in Washington, Michigan. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Glad to hear you. Yes, I was in Poland, Tom, last year, and I asked our tour guide, why aren't you on the euro?
No, they use the zloty there, don't they?
I'm sorry, what?
They use the zloty there? It's been a while since I was in Poland.
They did not transfer to the euro,
right?
Which I thought, you know, most European countries did. And, the dollar was worth 135 to a zloty, and they just keep their sovereignty and didn't give up to, I don't understand why other countries just bailed into to the euro.
There are two pieces to the eurozone, Judy, and and it's confusing to most Americans because we think of it as one thing, right? There's the eurozone, there's the EU, all this kind of stuff. But there is, first of all, basically a trade and immigration confederation, which is the European Union, which is not the eurozone. It's the European Union. And the European, and if you're a member of the European Union, as Poland, I believe, is, I could be wrong. I'd have to double check that.
Yeah.
But as, you know, England is, for example, which doesn't use the euro, or, you know, the Scandinavian countries that don't use the euro. If you're a member of the European Union, what that means is that you can trade with other European countries without any tariff barriers at all. And that if you're a citizen of any of those countries, you can move anywhere you want. So there's been a massive immigration into the wealthy countries, Germany, France, and England in particular, and out of the poorer countries, like, you know, that are just kind of peripherally part of, that are part of the European Union, but not part of the Eurozone, like Hungary, for example, I believe, and Poland. So though they're in the EU mostly to prevent World War III. I mean, the Europe is the continent that has had more wars and more violence than any other continent in the history of the human race. And the goal of the European Union was to make sure that there's never another, you know, kind of rise of Hitler sort of thing. Then in addition to that, this guy who invented Reaganomics came along and said, now, we need a common currency for the creme de la creme of the European Union. And we'll call that the Eurozone for the healthy economies. And you can't have an annual budget deficit that's greater than 3% of your GDP. And there's all these rules that are basically kind of Republican economic rules, you know. And you've got to use this common currency, so you no longer have sovereignty over your currency. You can no longer devalue your currency or increase the value of your currency, for that matter, in order to give yourself trade advantages or in order to deal with economic downturns. You have to run your social welfare programs the way we tell you, which is over time we're going to basically destroy these programs. And it was the euro was created. The guy who created it just came right out and said he was created to lower taxes and do away with government regulations and to dismantle the social welfare state in Europe. And it's been happening in those states that have adopted the euro. And so they're really two different things. And I think the eurozone, the countries that are using the euro, deserves to collapse. Or at least to contract to the point where it's only maybe five or six really wealthy nations, you know, Germany, France, Belgium, Holland. I don't know who else would be in it, Liechtenstein or something. You know, the countries that are quite well, Switzerland perhaps, although Switzerland is not part of the Eurozone. They are part of the European Union. And I believe, I'm pretty sure. You don't think so? Troy doesn't think so. Switzerland.
I'm sorry. My point was when I was in Poland, I got the feeling that they had thought it through, that we're sovereign and we're not giving up our money.
Yeah, it may be. Yeah, I mean, it may well be.
Something better than you know, giving up.
It may well be, or it could be that their economy wasn't just, it just wasn't large enough and powerful enough that the banksters wanted to bring them in, you know. And that was certainly the case with Greece. Greece did not qualify to join the Eurozone and start using the euro.
Okay.
And so Goldman Sachs went to them and said, you know, we'll buy some of your debt so that it doesn't look like you're exceeding that 3% debt threshold and make it look like it's not debt and, you know, get you in. And they did that, and they were on the course to pay back Goldman Sachs because their economy was growing. And then 2008 happened, you know, the Great Bush Depression. And suddenly, Goldman Sachs and the banks were saying to Greece, we want our money. But yeah, it may well be, Judy. I don't know the story.
One more thing, Tom. As a tourist in Poland, my buck was worth 135 compared to Zloty, and there were a lot of people that are tourists and going out to eat. And anyways, the devaluation for them, you know, just worked out well.
Yeah, exactly, and that's my point. If Greece was to go back to the drachma and devalue it, say half against the euro, suddenly every tourist
facility in all of Greece would cost, for a foreigner using foreign currency, half as much as it costs right now. And Greece would recover really, really quickly because there would be this explosion. Anyhow, Judy, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up? 1 minute, by the way, to the end of the show, Morris.
Not a problem. Why was it so important for corporations to get constitutional amendment protections?
So that they could dominate their workers and seize control of the political process and make more money for the fat cats?
So that does make a difference, the fact that corporations are listed in a constitutional amendment? It makes a difference?
Well, there's no mention of corporations in the Constitution.
But there is a constitutional amendment. I think it's 14.
Oh.
Which
says that the United States shall not deny any person shall not deny them equal protection under the law. And in 1886, the Supreme Court arguably, at least the headnote of the ruling, said that the court said that corporations are people. And that was to the benefit of Jay Gould and the other robber barons, the railroad barons. They were the ones who brought the case.
I guess. Appreciate your time.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Morris. Great talking with you. I wrote about this in my book, Unequal Protection, by the way. There's a whole chapter about how it came about. Thank you all for calling today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Thank you for being part of our program. Thank you for being part of America. And don't forget, you know, being an American has an obligation. Well, being a citizen of any country has an obligation to make democracy work, to make the political process work for all. For all humans, for all life on Earth. It takes all of us. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.